We love good food. We love to cook. And we especially love the conviviality that comes with a long, leisurely meal with family and friends. And so today we pause to ask, why don't we open a restaurant and become chef?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 966th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron.
Yes.
Do you like to eat good food?
Absolutely.
Good enough. Producer Kristen Carlson. Kristen, do you like to cook good food?
Absolutely.
Oops, there you go. Say that one more time.
Yes, I do.
Okay, and also producer Anna Ringelman. Anna, do you like the conviviality of sharing good food with family and friends?
I do. It's the very best.
Okay, folks, there it is. Few of our endeavors are more enjoyable than having a long, leisurely meal with family or friends. But to make the meal truly enjoyable, somebody in the kitchen must know how to cook. Now, it's one thing to be a good cook at home, where family and friends tend to be forgiving. But it's another thing to be a great chef in a restaurant, where customers pay a lot of money and tend to be demanding and unforgiving. This thought leads us to ask, what are the odds of a good cook becoming a successful chef? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Chef Enzo Fargioni, who is also the author of Visual Eats. Chef Enzo, welcome to the Food Chain. Well, let's see. There we go. Let's try that. You got you now?
Okay. Good morning.
We've got you. Chef Enzo, Visual Eats. What the heck are you talking about, Visual Eats?
Visual Eats is a, the saying, the culinary saying, you don't only eat with your mouth. You eat with all five senses. Today, gastronomy and all the culinary aspect of eating and cooking and dining out and the service industry is so complex and so avant-garde, if I may say so, that you use all five senses to properly enjoy a meal. Regardless if you're a foodie or not, you see the plate, you taste it, you smell it, you touch it, you have different textures. And so when I wrote a book, Visual Eats, I wanted to make sure that I incorporate not only the visual aspect of any particular dish that I create or I serve in my restaurants and so on, but also some of the stories about what takes to become a chef and my personal memories growing up throughout the hassles of the culinary schools work for free, long hours, just because you want to learn, and so on. So visually, it's really kind of collects a personal history of myself growing up as a young entrepreneur and a culinary interested persona, and also puts together all the visual aspects of cooking and what it takes to create such a dish and all the assholes and all the good and bad part of it.
Well, Chef Enzo, Farzioni sounds suspiciously Italian, of course. And we all know that Italian food is among the world's best for some reason or another. But why? Why is Italian food always looked up to so?
Well, first of all, it's a very old country. So there are traditions and there are traditions that actually respect the traditions, I should say. When people think Italian food, it's wrong. It's not Italian food that makes what Italian food is today. It's Italian regional cooking. That's what makes Italian food. There are 21 provinces in Italy. In each provinces, they create and they've been creating such a great food over the hundreds of years. So we have recipes that date even far back and before the Medici, and even far back, actually at the time of the Romans, the Roman Empire. So there is a tradition, and mostly tend to the conditions, geological conditions of Italy, the way it is geographically placed. It is a peninsula, is attached three quarters by water, and we have mountains and prairies and so on. So in a way, it's very easy, and we've been blessed to have such incredible and rich land, which we can really spoil ourselves each and every day of our life.
How would you characterize the difference between French cuisine and Italian cuisine? Which is best, by the way?
It's a very nice and tricky question to ask an Italian chef. I'm sure a French chef will probably answer the same way, I will assume. But, those are two countries that probably have some of the best culinary history in the world, French and Italy. The difference is geographical situation of where would they place, where would they are. One is north, the other one is a little bit south. France is touched by the sea only on the south in the Languedoc area, or in the Riviera, all the way up to, where Normandy is. So it's kind of limited for that. It's not a peninsula. The food in Isan, it's a little bit richer because they use a little bit more of, natural fat, such as heavy cream and butter. In Italy, we do that as well, mostly in the North Italy, like in Piedmont and Lombardy regions and so on. But the usage of high fat products kind of drops drastically as you go down towards the south of Italy. So anything below Florence, so Rome and Naples and Calabria, and then go to Sicily, that's where the Mediterranean diet comes in, because it's much lighter. So we use more olive oil, natural ingredients, lighter. It's a way that cooking that is also a little bit different from one another, because being a little bit more up in the north in France, you tend to cook more of a robust cuisine, just because also the high temperature and whatever the land offers. In Italy, we have a choice.
You can go both ways. What about, it seems like most of the great restaurants or the great cuisines of the world come from the temperate climates. Are there any good restaurants in places like Scandinavia, like Denmark, for example? Any good restaurants up there?
Well, there are a few notoriously great restaurants. The San Pellegrino 50 best restaurants, I think it just happened this past week. They're proclaiming the first 50 restaurants in the world. And for the past 2-3 years, there was always the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen in Denmark, which was number one in the world.
Wow.
Now, even though it's a very political list, the chef Renato Zeppi has done an incredible and very painstaking work on to use and only use the ingredients that the land offers. So he's not going to get pasta from Italy or import the butter made, high fat butter made in France. So he uses only the ingredients that are right there surrounding in a few miles area, if I may be that specific. There are great restaurants up there. It's much more difficult to obtain great results. And you need to have a little bit of a combination of someone that is adventurous, has a good basic of cooking, he understands the importance of fresh ingredients. He has a basic understanding on how to combine. And then, of course, there is the percentage that applies to each and any chefs or restaurant in the world. You need to have a good percentage of luck. And you have to have the right concept at the right time with the trend that is going at the moment.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of ingredients go into making a good restaurant. But the fact that the world's number one restaurant, political as that might be, is in way up there in Denmark, gives hope to all of those who don't live like in Italy. Maybe we can get in on the game too, which is the game today. Is can we become great restaurant chefs? And we're asking one what it takes. That would be Chef Enzo Fargioni, who is the author of Visual Eats and a chef at some very famous restaurants in one of the best places in the world to be, to have a restaurant, Washington, D.C., because that's where all the money is. You're invited to participate. If you have a question for the chef, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Questions we're going to put on the table today: what kind of ingredients must a successful chef bring to the table? How must a chef combine the ingredients to cook up a successful restaurant? And what are the odds of you and I becoming a great chef? Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Right back with Chef Enzo and you.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, fess up, folks. You love good food. You love to cook a little bit. You love the conviviality of family and friends joining in a long, leisurely meal. So why not open a restaurant and become chef? That's quite a title if you think about it, because I think there's a lot more into that than just cooking good food. Is that not right, Chef Enzo?
Correct. There's a lot more to it, unfortunately. And it's incredibly demanding and tiring profession.
Is that why all chefs are all happy all the time?
You know, chefs have a reputation to be weird. You know, people say, oh, the guy is weird. This chef is weird. He yells and screams and does things different. One time I saw him eating Chinese food. Or, you know, chefs are people. First and foremost, there are people that have a passion, that have a drive, they have a goal in life, and they mostly respect the profession for what it really is. Incredibly tiring and demanding, and it's a very, very painful profession. Mm-hmm. It destroys, in so many ways, relationships, families, makes you age faster. You work on your feet all day long. You mostly work when everybody else is resting, like on Sunday or Easter or Passover or Christmas, and so on. So there is a saying in the industry, if you don't love it, just get out of the industry, because eventually you're going to get tired. Eventually you're going to burn out. Eventually you're going to start to hate it. So for those that think about, I want to be a chef, you better really be genuinely passionate about it, because if you're not passionate about it, eventually you're going to drop out, because it's such a demanding industry that you're going to end up hating it.
Mm-hmm. You were passionate. Where did you get your passion?
Well, my passion started, well, first of all, I'm a very lucky person. I'm very lucky because I was born and I grew up in Italy. But that doesn't, it's not that that makes me lucky. What makes me lucky is that I was able to be exposed to the traditions of good and genuine good food and cooking since the young age, early years. I remember my mom is an exceptional great cook. And she used to cook. And also my grandmother, which is still alive, she's 96. They both used to meet in the kitchen on the Sundays, and they started, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, they start to cook a meal for all of us in the family, and sometimes we have relatives coming in and so on. So it wasn't unusual for us to have sometimes 20 people on Sunday in a house, and all these demanding diners. They didn't want it in architecturally composed food on their plate. They wanted to have real good food. So I remember the fumes of the cooking fumes that kind of capture me from under the door in my room and wake me up and drag me out of bed early in the morning. And that's when my passion really started. That's why I was so lucky that I was exposed to what the trend is today, you know, the cooking, everything from scratch, and making the fresh pasta, and making all the sauces, and roast the meats, and bake the fish, and making desserts. So I witnessed that. I witnessed that on my own skin. I saw it. I was able to taste it. I was able to like it, to eat it, and to fully understand. So that's a very, very big plus. There's a major plus for everyone.
Do you think we can hold on to those? Did you think we could find those traditions as we live out our city-centered, urban, always on the go, always rushing to get here and there lifestyles? Do you think we can refine those traditions in cookbooks or something, on television?
It's very hard. Television is somehow kind of delivered that enthusiasm and that through those traditions, but it's all tied up to a game show or a different goal, which usually is profits, money for network. In cookbooks, you know, I wrote a book as well, and
Visual Eats.
Yes, Visual Eats, in which knowing that you don't make money writing a book, so I wasn't driven by the desire of making millions of dollars writing a book. I knew from the beginning that you don't make millions of dollars anymore nowadays, unfortunately. Very few can. But I was driven, I felt compelled to tell a story about the traditions or cooking traditions and what it really takes to open a restaurant, to be a chef, to become a chef, all the ups and downs, all the personal experiences with big time chefs, the biggest chefs in the world right now that I had the pleasure to working with, and most of them they're friends still today. So I was an incredibly lucky individual, lucky little boy back then, that I was exposed to all these incredible inspiration figures and things.
It was really more than anything the smell coming underneath your bedroom door, right? That was really what did it, wasn't it?
It really was back then. It really was because I love to eat. I don't like to overeat. I love to eat, and I love. I'm the kind of guy that Michael, if you and I will go to a restaurant we've never been, I will probably order 60-70% of whatever's on the menu. Not because I'm going to eat at all, but you probably will think that I'm crazy. In so many ways, I am. But for me, it's the passion, is the curiosity to see how the particular dish is executed. So even if I have a bite of it, or two bites, I understand it. I understand it, I appreciate it, and I value the work that is behind, or the single motion of bringing a plate in front of you when you sit at a restaurant. I know what takes to do that.
Well, let's bring some of the the ingredients it takes to build successful restaurant business to the table here. I mean, that's what a chef must do. He must be the person, he or she must be the person that brings these ingredients to the table. First, of course, is the food. What kind of food do we bring to the table?
Well, I always, you know, every time I'm interviewed or I'm asked to speak about food and so on, or even when I talk to friends or even do an interview for a position, I always tell people, you know, don't think too hard. Don't think about combining ingredients that don't necessarily mix together. And just because you want to be colorful, but just because you want to be different, just because you want to get you want to be noticed by the press. All that, it will come later, if it comes. But be more humble and concentrate on really outsource the food, the ingredients per se. I always tell everybody, give me a great tomato. I guarantee you, I'm going to make a wonderful tomato sauce. I'm going to cut the basil by hand. I'm going to put the extra virgin olive oil in the last second. I'm going to slice the garlic by hand. You know, you smell it, you see it, it's nice and bright. It tastes glorious. It's fantastic. But give me a rotten tomato. I will make a tomato sauce, but I can guarantee you that tomato sauce, by nighttime, is going to bubble. It's rotten. It's sour. Eat it, throw it away. So you need to be, the first thing I will say is, I'm very adamant about this, is really be picky with what kind of ingredients you cook with. Search for good tomatoes. Search for good herbs. Search for all these mushrooms are halfway okay. I don't know. Maybe they cost a little bit less, a little bit more. And again, it all depends on what you want to do. What drives you? What kind of dish you have to execute? But again, the ingredients is a must. You have to start from the basics because then everything's going to crumble in the end.
And so the ingredients of food, hugely significant. What about the cost of that food? It's one thing to go in search of the perfect tomato, but holy smokes, who's going to pay for that? I guess that's something we're going to have to pick up when we get back, which is the cost of our ingredients, which is the food. How can we balance the cost with what the restaurant patron is going to pay? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here with a telephone ringing in the background. Chef Enzo Fargioni, Visual Eats. You have some very famous restaurants in Washington, D.C. And that's one of the things I'd like to talk about is the location. That seems to be a very important ingredient in the mix of whether you can be a successful restaurateur or not.
Well, there are many, many components.
And we will be right back, so please do stay tuned. Well, we're having a little bit too much fun here talking about food off the air, and then we should continue on the air. So we were talking a little bit about with Chef Enzo Fargioni, author of Visual Eats, about cost of foods in the restaurant trade. You know, we were talking about going in search of the perfect tomato and how with a perfect tomato you can make the perfect tomato sauce, and with a rotten tomato, you of course make rotten tomato sauce. But how does the cost of that perfect tomato determine what your restaurant is going to be, Chef?
Well, you know, there is a commercial formula. I know that there is this urban legend that that restaurant is supposed to draw a profit, everything is, in old days, was calculated three times for whatever you buy. For instance, a tomato, as you mentioned, may cost, let's just say, $1. So I would have to sell the tomato $3 at least in order to have a 33% food cost. Now, that's, nowadays, it's a formula that does not work. So a few years back, everybody went back and changed that kind of formula to four times.
Wow, so if a tomato costs $1, you have to charge $4 for the tomato?
Well, that would be the commercial formula in order for a restaurant to be profitable. Now, there are some ingredients in which you can do it. Some other, for instance, pasta. You make a fresh pasta in at the restaurant. It doesn't really cost you that much, about 10 cents per portion, just flour, egg, in order to make it, and then you cook it, and then you put the sauce and so on, you sell it. Probably that cost a couple of dollars, $3. It really depends what, you know, the sauce is, meat, or if you prefer truffles, for instance, it's something completely different. But a basic pasta dish, a 4-ounce pasta, sold at a restaurant, you probably cost just an average between $4, I would say. And, you know, you do resell it in a fine dining restaurant, you do resell it even up to $20, $25. So there is a huge amount of marginal profit for certain items. But then again, they have a nice prime cut of beef tenderloin or a ribeye. You know, you can hardly do three times on that because nobody's going to buy a cut of meat that costs $60, $70. It's very few can afford it, and very few can really appreciate it. Therefore, the way, even though you apply the formula in a restaurant, that is just an idea on guidelines on how to, for you to know if you're doing a good job in trying to keep the restaurant profitable or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty good idea then, that there are some careful calculations that we must make to be a successful chef there then, with respect to the kind of food we sell and its cost, and then the kind of customers that we're going to be working with. One of the things that I always wondered about restaurants is that, you know, we all get tired of eating the same kind of food all the time. How does a successful chef manage variety? You know, you have to keep doing the same things to make it work, but then you have to keep changing too, don't you?
Correct. But then, you know, you hit around the nose. It really depends on the chef and how driven he is. I am, you know, one of the chefs that I like to, and I love to cook with the season. In a fine dining restaurant, tasty menu restaurant, like the one I had in Washington, D.C., I used to change the tasty menu every 2-3 weeks, just because the variety, the ideas that I had, because I'm a very driven person, maybe too much. And mostly because the seasons, you know, it changes the season, and you are able to really take advantage of the season. The mushrooms are coming in, fresh porcini mushrooms. In the fall, for 4 months, you have white truffles, which, of course, they are important from Alba. But, again, you work with the season. So you're able to use them to offer those items that basically you can only have it for 2, 3, 4 months out of the year. And for those who love it, you know, it's a wonderful way to appreciate it. Now, for instance, we have out in Oregon, they have farms of mushrooms farms. They have porcini mushrooms, they have morels mushrooms, they have chanterelles, you know, the black trumpets. They have wonderful mushrooms. Sometimes, unfortunately, whenever a restaurant I can only speak for myself in Washington, D.C., you order from your purveyors a case of chanterelle mushrooms. Sometimes, they are imported because they are scarce maybe here in the United States. They have to really outsource it, and then you end up buying a product that is not really top quality for so much money. So when you buy something like that, and you accept and you have to work with something, that you're almost forced to work with something like that, then you have no choice, unfortunately. Or you have the choice not to use it. Now, if this is an item that you have in your menu and it's a set menu, you need to use it. You need to, of course, apply it and implement it because your customer wants it. That's why sometimes you see changes in prices, because the season changes. Because too much rain out there in Washington State, well, it's going to either benefit or really it's going to destroy the harvest, the mushroom harvest. Therefore, the price changes. And you have to change accordingly. Otherwise, again, the formula that you apply in order to keep the restaurant profitable will be useless. So it's kind of hard. It's very, you almost have to do a full cost with each item that you have almost on a daily basis.
Well, that kind of brings up the next question, because, of course, when we go to a restaurant, we all want to know what we're going to get. So consistency is so important. So how can you be consistent when there's so many incredible, crazy variables that you have to deal with?
Well, that's why you have a variety of restaurants. And what I'm saying is we have a food chain restaurant, we have tasty menu restaurants, and you have just a regular mom-and-pop restaurant or just a chain restaurant. Now, the difference between all of this is about the concept and profit margin and what kind of the concept per se is being targeted to a very small kind of crowd. For instance, tasty menu restaurant. You know, in a tasty menu, you can spend anywhere between, I don't know, $70 for a tasty menu, let's say a number, all the way up to $250 if you go to New York, some of the 3-star Michelin restaurants. But you know that the menu is being crafted based only on what you can actually find on the market fresh that week. Therefore, you pay for it. It's the best they can find in the market. They buy it. They cook it. They create something exceptional for you. You pay the price. You know that all, you know, up front before you sit down. Some of the chain restaurants, they have a way of cooking that has to be consistent with what the demand is and has to also be very profitable. Therefore, sometimes they buy frozen items.
Sure.
Put in the freezer, they defrost it. So that's why there is a consistency, because they don't really work respecting the season, but respecting the concept of the restaurant itself.
Okay. And then, of course, with the fast food restaurants, you're pretty much going to be consistent because it all comes frozen from someplace. When we come back, I'd like to talk with one of the other subjects that always pops up, and that, of course, is location. Location always seems to be an issue, as they say in real estate, location, location, location. And that seems to be a big one. And Chef Enzo Fargioni, he's really a clever guy. Not only is the author of Visual Eats, but he has tasting restaurants in Washington, D.C., and that is where all the money is. Do stay tuned. So in my neck of the woods, there's a restaurant on a hill. And it's a huge amount of traffic that goes by this restaurant. But it never seems to hold any restaurant. There's always a sign up that says, now open. So I think so many restaurants go open up in this place and fail that they just leave the now open sign up. And I think that's the name of the restaurant. And so when you think about opening a restaurant, I guess you have to really think about where you're going to open it. And I think if you're going to open a fine dining restaurant, one of the smartest places in the world to open one would be Washington, D.C. Why? Well, that's where all the money's at. Just like Willie Loman used to say about robbing banks, right? Go to where the money is. So is that a good place to open a bank? You've certainly been there, Chef Enzo Fargioni. You've opened restaurants in Washington, D.C. Good place?
Washington, D.C. has changed dramatically for the past 15 years, 10 years, I should say. You know, we often talk about food cities. So we talk with so much respect about New York and San Francisco and Chicago and Philadelphia and so on. Well, Washington, D.C. emerged as one of the top 10 food cities in America, probably in about 2006, 2007. And that is because the food scene has changed dramatically. Many more restaurants have opened of any kind or any nationality or any concept, really. Many celebrity chefs have made Washington, D.C. their home, or at least they opened one of their signature restaurants in there. And then there is, of course, many different other concepts that, almost on a weekly basis, I should say, that they open and they're trying to do something different and something unique. Washington, indeed, has become a food city and a respected food city. And it's, I'd say, you know, when I first came in Washington, D.C. in 1986, there were about 3-4 restaurants, and they were all mediocre. They really were. Now it's almost hard to have a bad meal in Washington, D.C. It's almost impossible. And that really brings a lot of pride, because, at least to me, because so many other chefs like myself or restaurateurs and so on who work so hard to really make sure that that we could really send an authentic and deliver an authentic message about our cuisine. So yes, Washington now it is a very good city to open a restaurant. It is, however, Washington, D.C., as much as I love Washington, D.C., as my second home, I would say, or like my equally my first home, like Torino in Italy, where I was born, I'd say that Washington, D.C. is extremely boring city, very diplomatic, very cosmopolitan. So if you're looking for the late-night action like in New York City, open 24 hours, you're not going to find it. 9:30, 10 o'clock top, or especially on weekdays, everything dies. So it's a city where it's alive, and the action lies during daytime and early hours of the evening.
So I would suspect lunch and early dinners would be probably where you live then, right?
Correct. That's when the restaurant really succeeds the most. It's, I would say, anywhere between the 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock top, unless, you know, and many restaurants, of course, like anywhere in the country, they're open 1 hour, 2 hours later in the weekend, Friday and Saturday, because, you know, Friday and Saturday, right, you have more attendance to your restaurant.
Chef, what about the ambiance of the restaurant itself? The, you know, when people walk in, we had a caller earlier who suggested his wife says that food tastes is largely determined by the mood when you sit down to eat. And I suspect the restaurant's ambience has a lot to do with that as well.
A lot. But, you know, let's not forget that when we go out to eat, we go out to eat because we want to have a good meal. The choice of a restaurant may be determined by the concept of the restaurant itself. Therefore, aesthetics and the way the restaurant is decorated, the concept of the restaurant and the location mostly. So if you're looking for something that is fast and great, you will probably go to the same restaurant every 2 to 3 weeks because there is a trust that the restaurant has earned from you as a customer, as a guest. Anytime we try a new restaurant, it's because there is this question mark that kind of flows over our head. What are we going to have? Well, you know, it's going to be a good restaurant. We don't know. You go try a new restaurant. Now, another thing I would like to highlight is the fact that in old days, and I'm talking about 25 years ago, pre-internet era, you go to a restaurant, the moment you walk in, you might probably heard, oh, the restaurant's doing this and that. So you have a little bit of an idea what the restaurant what was doing, but you really didn't know. So you will go to a restaurant, you will sit down, it will be a complete new experience, and the experience wouldn't be bastardized, I should say, by all the little information that you would get before. Nowadays, by the time you try to try a new restaurant as a diner, you can put it up online, you can see the menu, you can see the decor, you can see the wine list, you have the count, you know what they are, and there are reviews from bloggers that nowadays, not everybody's a food critic. So I like the post-internet era, that is much better because it gives so much more information. But I'm sad in a way because it takes away the element of surprise for dining.
Sure, everything's pretty well described for you. Well, I have a good friend who owns a restaurant, and he did a remarkable thing. He, as a chef, he's a professional chef, and he decided that the cooks needed to make more money, or at least as much money, as the waiters. So he forced the waiters into sharing their tips with the cooking staff. So now he has great food and bad service. When we come back, I'd like to ask Chef Enzo, what's most important, the cooks or the waiters? Do stay tuned. What do you think out there? When you go into a restaurant, which is most important? How you are treated or what you are treated with? And so the question for Chef Enzo Fargioni, the author of Visual Treats and a chef of restaurants, of fine dining restaurants throughout the Washington, D.C. area. Chef, what do you think? Who do you think should make the most money, the cooks or the wait people?
Well, you know, both. Very much so. You cannot really single things out. The experience that a diner has in a restaurant, it's created by the experience of both. You know, everyone eats out, whatever restaurant may be, expensive, inexpensive, fast food, and fine dining, so on. But you know, you as a customer, when you go out to eat, what really impresses you? What really makes you think about the restaurant? It's something that you, the restaurant was able to voluntarily, was able to give you, because your experience at that restaurant, and boy, you voluntarily take it with you when you walk out those doors, it's like, to me, it's like when you watch a movie. The next thing, you know, sometimes you watch a great movie, it stays with you, feelings come up, you go home, you sleep, the next day, it becomes a topic of conversation. So, you say, you remember the movie, that was wonderful. Same thing when you have a dining experience. Well, the restaurant was better than I expected. You know what they did. They did this, this, and that, and then they do that. So it's a wonderful thing when everything clicks together, when the diner is surprised with more than he was expecting, and in quality, of course. Now, what is more important? They're equally both important. You can have incredible, great food and a really bad service, you know, or you can have the most incredible service ever, but the food, I mean, you would just want to open a can of tuna and eat it because you're desperate. So everything has to be balanced and combined. The service has to be structured and organized and customized based on the type of cuisine that you're having, that you serve. You go to, if you have a fine dining restaurant, you have to be careful that, you know, and be aware that, you know, part of the training for instance, at my restaurant where I'm fine dining, everybody has to lift the food for the table at the same time. Everybody has to put it down at the same time. You don't have to backhand. You serve ladies first, and then younger ladies, then younger gentlemen, and gentlemen, senior gentlemen. So there are rules and regulations in a way that needs to be matched with the quality of the food.
Chef, who is responsible for making everything click at a restaurant?
Well, you always to surround, you know, what I do, I always generally surround myself by professional and people, even if they're not professional, they are people that are genuinely passionate about food and wine.
But who's responsible, Chef? Who's the one that's responsible?
Well, everybody's responsible. For instance, many people may be responsible. Ultimately, everybody's responsible. Everybody has the utmost respect for what we're doing and the responsibility to make sure that you do your job the way you were trained to do it.
And thank you very much. We're out of time, Chef, but I just want to say thank you for making this connection. Chef Enzo Fargioni, Visual Treats. Can we become a chef? What do you think?
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.